Hello, everybody, and good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network. And you can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark. I hope you don't mind that I jumped in on your intro there.
You did. You almost messed me up.
I've wanted to do that for 6 years.
So basically during the show, I get 30 seconds uninterrupted, uninterrupted, and you had to take that away.
Sorry. That's all I got. Hey, it's almost Christmas, buddy.
It is almost Christmas.
Uncommon economic indicators. Life is good. You know, we've been talking a lot about business is good, but also it's not just business, and I'm not just talking about in our own restaurants. Mm. The tenor of the dining room.
Yeah, we
different.
Talked about this a little bit last week. You know,
yeah, people and it's just continued.
People are happier, and you know, you're seeing that kind of, you know, mostly good news in the stock markets, although up and down. Every day is different. But in the restaurant, it's not like that. You don't see, you know, those swings,
daily swings,
those daily
yeah.
swings, and those daily mood swings. We're seeing generally that an uptick in how people are feeling.
And we talked a little bit last week about how people are really embracing the season this time around. Some of truffles, caviar, champagne, foie gras are going out. Thank heaven, because that's what we sell, and well, that's what I like.
They're delicious.
They're delicious, but. Also, people are really embracing the season, and I think there are a couple of reasons behind this. People are really embracing holiday drinks. They're really embracing Christmas cocktails, Tom and Jerry's, eggnogs, all sorts of holiday festive mm-hmm. drinks. And that's, you know, it's not a new phenomenon because it has happened for a long time. I remember a story. We once worked next to a bar. The bar is defunct now, so we can talk about mm-hmm. the shortcomings of it. But I want to preface it by saying it was one of the most important bars in the development of downtown New Brunswick. There was a place called J. Period August, you know, a little take on the French "j'auguste," right? Isn't that what that's?
I never knew what
There's
that
a
meant.
French term "j'auguste," which means we'll have to look that up. What that means, but
I'm big.
J. Only when you say it. I think it's something like, you know, it's festive. Right. We'll have to look that up.
I'm August.
Okay, this is the listener question here. If you know what J'auguste means, please email mark@restaurantguysradio.com and you'll win a prize. Not sure what that is, but
so
it'll
I
be something.
So I can stop but talking out of my butt.
And you'll win a prize because we're going to have a lot of stuff to re-gift in a couple of weeks, so we'll have stuff laying around. You never know what you're going to get. But J. August, I remember 1986, my first bartending job in New Brunswick. You came to work there a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. The staff there was really personable and really great. It wasn't a well-run bar in some respects. One of those respects was they had a great soul of what they wanted to do, but they didn't really get the customer service memo. And I remember I used to work, and they'd say, oh, you know, we're making mulled cider tonight. John's making mulled cider behind the bar. I'm like, oh, I love hot apple cider. Oh, with a little bit of applejack in it or maybe a little bit of whiskey. And, oh, gosh, I love that. And every time I get over there, if I get over there later than 7 o'clock, I'm like, hey, you got any of that mulled cider? Like, no, staff drank it. It's so good.
Yeah, I definitely think that one of the reasons, and J. August, again, I agree with Francis, was a great place. It was a fun place. But one of the reasons it was fun is because the staff was always hammered.
Yeah. Okay. We owned the bar next door. And
we didn't own it.
And No. And
we worked
in the bar next door. Sorry about that. We worked in the bar next door as bartenders, and our friends who were bartenders from across the street would come over, and they would say, hey, how's it going? Hey, how you doing, man? Can I get a shot? Sure, a shot. Can a beer? Sure, is a beer. So you off tonight? No, just taking a break. Like, yeah, we don't do that over here.
Bar's really busy. I needed a break.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly. Yeah, nobody ever took a break, by the way, when there was only two people at the bar. They take a break when there's 100 people at the bar.
I got to get out of here.
Oh, this place is crazy.
My favorite was we worked a New Year's Eve one night, and we met the bartenders from across the street or afterwards for drinks because we were the bartenders. We both mm-hmm. worked together behind the bar, and we had a slamming New Year's Eve, and we had the deal that whoever got out first. We went at somebody's house afterwards or something. We said whoever got out first would host the other people for, you know, a post-bartending nightcap, which, in case you're wondering, is about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
On New Year's Eve. So whoever got out first, and they got out first. Now, we had a much more rigorous cleaning protocol, but they had a much bigger bar and a bigger bar staff. So it was sort of a toss-up. And so we're telling war stories about the night. And New Year's Eve is, you know, that's a night to work in the restaurant business. I haven't had a night off in a long time. And so this we're talking about how we were so busy. We were so busy. It sometimes took a couple minutes to get a drink. We're so busy. I had to get, you know, change the kegs 4 times. We're so busy. And one of the guys who worked in the other bar said, yeah, we were so busy for a while there, we didn't have time to ring up any of the drinks.
Oh, dear.
And it was met from Mark and I with a moment of silence, like, yeah, huh? And I said, You're kidding, right? He's like, no, for like an hour and a half, we were too busy making the drinks, didn't have time to ring any up. And I thought, oh my God.
Oh boy.
Oh my God.
But I got to tell you, it was a great place to go.
Till it went out of business, it was a great place to go.
It was a great place to go.
Yeah, no, it was. And New Brunswick was a hell of a town back then. And
it's still a hell of a town.
But it's
got a different cool to it than
it's
it had
a much
back
nicer
then.
Town.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, we were also 21 and 22 years old.
So I had a different cool too. So back then.
Yeah. Well, but getting back to the topic of Christmas drinks. The spiced cider that you would occasionally get, like the Holy Grail at Joe August's, but now we have Tom and Jerry's, which we've been serving for a couple of years, and they were met with from the people who tried them. They love them.
And Tom and Jerry's are a batter made hot drink that go all the way back to Jerry Thomas. I mean,
the first American cocktail.
Exactly.
But they were very, very, very popular. If you go online and you look up Tom and Jerry bowls or Tom and Jerry mugs, you'll find that, you know, every household in the 40s and 50s had a Tom and Jerry bowl. You wouldn't entertain without them in the wintertime.
And basically you kept the batter in the Tom and Jerry bowl, and then you would add hot water or liquor or whatever your Tom and Jerry recipe was, you would add to this Tom and Jerry batter. And that would make this delicious hot concoction.
And by the way, make some now and keep it in a mason jar in the kitchen and put a couple of spoonfuls in the bottom of a mug and then fill it with hot water or hot milk. You can look up the recipe. It's great. You can even go to restaurantguysradio.com. We'll put that up. We'll put that link up.
That's a good idea. We should definitely put a Tom and Jerry recipe up.
But it's funny. We introduced those and people looked at us like sort of out of the side of their faces for a while. Mm-hmm. And then the people who had them loved them. But it really took a while for this whole idea of warm drinks to really take hold. But we now do a hot buttered rum. We do a hot spiced Applejack. We do a Tom and Jerry. And, you know, I go around New York and I see everybody's got all the cool cocktail bars have a warm drink as well. And on a cold day and around the holidays, what's better than that?
I mean, especially, and this is not to disparage any of those cool cocktail bars because I love almost all of them. But in some of those, you walk in, and if you're sitting too close to the drapes that are covering the door, you get a little wisp of winter every 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely true. Well, anyway, I love the sort of embracing the holiday season with them. If you guys want to try that at home, we'll throw up the Tom and Jerry recipe, which was adapted from one that I got from Dale DeGroff many years ago. I don't know where he got it from. And we use it every year. I use it at home all the time. Dangerous stuff, though. Very careful.
But great. You don't have to put that much alcohol in if you don't want to.
Why would you not want to? what are you talking about?
If you wanted to drink a lot of them.
Oh, I see. Again, what are you talking about? Just arrive at your destination before you try them. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with Doug Frost as our guest today. He's an old friend, and he is one of the few people in the world who is both a master sommelier and a master of wine, and he also knows quite a bit about the cocktails we're talking about. So stick with us. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and in restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Doug Frost. Doug is a master sommelier. Doug is also a master of wine. He's one of only three people in the world to have both of those titles. He's also one of the founding members of the Beverage Alcohol Resource Group that you've heard us talk about, and we've had David Wunderch and Dale Groff on the show to talk about that in the past. And you're probably the most degreed person in libational recreation.
Hey, Doug. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm from Kansas City. I'm very, very insecure, so I needed, you know, titles and such.
I tell you, that one of only three people in the world to be an MS and an MW, that's pretty cool.
It's, you know, it's pretty funny. There'll be another guy along shortly. He's almost done. Eric Heimer out of Florida. I don't mean to jinx him, but, you know.
I was going to say, if he dies, if his brakes fail going around a bend, we're coming looking for you.
No, I've been trying to help him along. It'll be great because it's been a decade since anybody got both of those exams complete. So it'll be great to have some company.
Now, just a question, and you can answer this truthfully or not as you'd like. Do you think it's harder now to finish those MS and those MWs than it was 20 years ago?
You know, it's an interesting question because it's the old, you know, I'm going to give you the sort of answer that an MW would definitely give you, which is it's both, interestingly. You know, but that's to say we can overthink anything. But it is that. There's a lot more information to cover than there used to be. But because of that, I would argue sometimes that the depth doesn't go quite, you know, as into exquisite detail, perhaps, as we might once have. And I would also argue that there's a great deal more help than there used to be. I mean, when I took the exams living in Kansas City, I had no, you know, virtually no help. I certainly had mentors in the business, but it was definitely something that I was doing in a vacuum. And now there are lots of classes and lots of mentor programs, you know, literally training programs and such for both programs that can assist people a great deal. But having said that, like I said, you know, MW mind, I can keep thinking of all sorts of ways to contradict myself. It's also true, I have always told people, particularly within the MS program, that it was great that I was from Kansas City and nobody knew me from Adam, because I didn't have the pressure that I often see people put upon themselves, because they're in New York City and what they're doing is very visible and everybody they know is going, so how's it going with program? How does that go? You know.
And if you're the sommelier at some bon vivant restaurant in New York City and you fail your master sommelier test, people are going to notice.
It's really true. It helps a great deal. I keep trying to tell people the best thing you can do is ignore it. Just don't talk to people about it. Don't participate in the conversation or the gossip. Just do it on your own.
You know, the other thing, you say you had mentors, and you used to call those mentors on a big phone the size of your head, or write them a letter on paper and put a stamp on it and send it in the mail, as opposed to, you know, the email, the internet, and, you know, all the resources.
And Google.
Dude, how old do you think I am? Oh, no, sorry, just kidding.
I see you,
no,
brother.
You're right. It was a very different world. I used to, you know, being of the age that I am, you know, you find yourself telling stories in which a pager features, you know, or something like that, and people are like, pager?
I've heard of such a thing. I saw that in a movie once. Well, you know, I think that Mark and I often talk about whether you're a degreed professional like you are, Master Wine, Master Sommelier, or just, you know, someone in the business as we are, who, you know, our job is to be a sommelier or a wine director or a retailer. And I think that the job has gone from being all about, when we first started, finding new products, you know, and learning about places that either we didn't know about or our guests didn't know about, because there wasn't really enough information out there. And now we almost have a different problem, which is, there's way too much information out there for anyone to sort of contextualize and make sense of.
Right,
and
it's hard to put a filter on.
And a lot of it's bad, you know, so you got to find the good from the bad information, and then you got to contextualize what good information you care about. Do you think that's the changing role of people like you?
Yeah, I do. I think, truthfully, I think it was also the situation 20 years ago when I finished these exams, or approximately 20 years ago, because, you know, you had the established voice in some quarters just bleeding out a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that stood in for information. But there's no question that it is more challenging now, because you've got this absolute flood of information and you've got to find a way to dig through it and find what's salient and find what is useful to people, and even sometimes find what is true and not what is.
Yeah, there's plenty of crap still out there, Doug.
Yeah, you're right.
But it's much easier to cross-reference now. I mean, I remember when Mark and I were learning about wine, you know, which was, I think we're contemporaries. Mark and I are 46. And, you know, you would read some stuff, and you'd read a book, and you'd think, oh, that's the truth. And of course, then you'd find five books would have five different things to say about the same thing in wine. And now what's easier to, if you care,
you can cross-reference. You know, you don't have you still got Wikipedia, which might be wrong, but you can then cross-reference it with a few other things, and eventually you can find the truth. You know, where I think that was a lot harder back in the day, don't you?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It was much more difficult to gather the information. Most of your time was spent doing that, and now I spend a lot of time trying to train people that the information is not what you need. The ability to synthesize that information and aggregate it into some kind of sensible narrative is what you're really trying to get to. Anybody can get the information, especially nowadays. So yeah, it's particularly within the MW, it's really the biggest challenge is getting people to stop being in love with your information and start thinking about what does that narrative mean to a normal, you know, consumer, to somebody, whether it's in a restaurant or retail setting or any other setting, why should they care?
So let's talk about how the world, another way in which the world has changed. There's a hell of a lot more great wine that to be had in America. There is a lot more information, and there are a lot more people who treat the wine business or the cocktail business or the restaurant business in general as a profession, right? We're going over into a service economy, but 20 years ago, you know, Mark was afraid to tell his grandmother that he still worked in the restaurant business after he got out of college.
Now I named a restaurant after her. Take that, Grandma.
Nice.
So, but now, you know, you see the amazing enthusiasm and professionalism among people who work in wine stores and sommeliers who work in restaurants, not just in the major cities. That has changed the landscape of being a consumer in a lot of ways. I mean, what do you think of the proliferation of MWs and MSs and really of MW and MS candidates, you know, who are populating the restaurants and liquor stores of America?
Well, I can only believe that, you know, it's increased the professionalism, it's increased the, or raised, if you will, the bar as to what information someone should know and what comprehension they should have throughout the industry. So to me, that's all to the good. I'm you know, very, very happy that there has been this sea change in it. I think it would be easy, I suppose, for somebody in my situation to find it somewhat threatening, you know, that this rarefied atmosphere is now being shared by a gaggle of humans, but it's fantastic, basically, because it means the bullshit is gone, or at least minimized.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just a lot of it, you know. I mean, there were a lot of people who pretended to knowledge that I think they really didn't have, or pretended that their information was somehow more correct than someone else's. You know, now for me, I think the next step is to get people to admit, is the way the verb I'd put on it, that there is room for disagreement, that differing palates create differing sensations, and therefore, you know, we don't agree as to what tastes delicious, we don't agree as to what the best example of some particular style is, and that's all to the good, and we're not supposed to. So I think, you know, now it's like, now that we've all agreed that there is, you know, a hierarchy, if you will, of information that's possible, it's now even more important to agree that it's not really a hierarchy after all. It is a more diverse world than that, and we need to, you know, sort of allow for lots of different viewpoints in this and find a way to speak through that noise. As you say, there's just so much information that it now becomes the challenge. How do you cut across all those spectrums and make it make sense to everybody you're talking to? And in a, you know, for me, I always come back to the restaurant setting, standing at a restaurant table. How do I talk to a table of four who are having pork chop, steak, Dover sole, and a vegetarian dish?
you
want one bottle.
You say, I was going to say, you say half bottle. Right, you say half bottle, is what you say. Now, you know, it's funny. I think there are two things there that you really hit upon that I think, and this show goes out to a lot of people who are in the wine business and the food business. And when you're educating the public, and look, people who are coming to dinner are not always looking to be educated, but when you're teaching wine classes or when you find people who are looking to be educated, there, one of the great distinctions that we've always found, and one of the really helpful and useful distinctions that we've always found, is which wine is better than the other. I mean, it's not like you always have to have a contest, right? Or what is a mark of quality? Well, that's a subjective decision that you make, or a subjective value judgment that you make overall. But there are objective things that we can determine that are the basis of discussion, and talking to consumers about that and saying, well, you know, how much acidity is in a wine? Well, that's a measurable, objective thing. Is that good or bad? Should it be higher or lower? Well, that's a subjective thing. And I think that's what we can offer as educators. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I think that's a really good way of putting it. Even to take it a step farther, because it's one of my obsessions, is to say that for a long time we trained ourselves that acidity really mattered, when it's probably pH that is more important, because that's going to be something that really shows up in somebody's, you know, mouth. It's going to have a visceral impact on their enjoyment or lack thereof. So it becomes an issue of, some of us are more or less sensitive to acid, some of us are more or less sensitive to bitterness and other factors like sweetness. So I can't tell you what the perfect wine is for you until you tell me what wines you like, and now we can start to walk down the path of, oh, cool, if that's what you like, you're going to love this.
Well, and you know, by the same token, I think there is a value to the same as, you know, what's good and bad literature, right? I mean, what's a good and bad painting? I mean, there are opinions on historical paintings have changed over the years. But I think that there is great value into taking someone who's knowledgeable, like yourself, or like someone who disagrees with you and is equally as knowledgeable and equally experienced about wine, and learning your perspective overall, and having that inform, you know, learning Doug Frost's perspective is a valuable thing. And then to know that and then form your own perspective is different than saying, you know, Parker gave it 100 points, I love it, and this is my point of view. I think there's still something to learn from people who, you know, have spent a lifetime learning about wine.
Yeah, I think the falsity of the 100 point system, you know, the silliness that it depicts really is built upon what some people I think still buy into, which is the notion that all palates are the same, that one palate is the best palate, and it can read wine better than your palate. And that's so crazy. I don't understand why anybody in the restaurant business ever let that happen, because we've never for a second believed that to be true about food.
Right.
I mean, you know, even though, yeah, somebody will say, no, you know, so-and-so's a particular version of a certain dish is the classic interpretation.
Doug, I can tell you why restaurant people let that happen and retailers let that happen. Because it sold more wine and it was easy. That's why they let it happen.
Yeah, it did. I guess my confusion is, particularly on the retail side, it took all the power out of their hands and handed it over to a third party who has no interest in the success or well-being of their business. So it seems ludicrous that they did so. You see now some retailers starting to put their own scores on the wall, and I encouraged people to do it 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. Actually, I went mad one Christmas. I got so angry at scores that I ran around the store. It was the best store in Kansas City at the time. And I started putting up tags saying 92 points, Doug says, 94 points. And the owner of the store just starts following me around going, you can't do that.
You know, I always wanted to come up with the 116-point scale. Oh, everyone
total.
In the store is over 100 points. You know,
total.
It's like...
Total.
You know, the analogy I always make with people who got obsessed about scores, and I will tell you, they did us a favor, because we started in 92, we opened our first restaurant, and we started in the business in 86. So this is when scores were just sort of starting to take off, and look, it got a lot of people excited about wine and got a lot of people into wine who hopefully broadened their view as time went on. But Mark and I, from the day we opened our restaurant, our goal was to find a wine that Robert Parker hates. You know, I want the low-scoring wine, and the way we made our living was to say, hey, they're wrong about this wine.
Right, and because what happened to those wines? They became easier to get.
Yeah,
yeah.
They became less expensive, and in some cases, they were great wines that scored low for one reason or another.
And I remember early on in our career, we really got behind a winemaker, a guy named Paul Hobbs, who's a friend, and we thought his wines were spectacular.
Yeah, Paul makes great wines.
And they were really, some of them were really relatively meagerly rated in the beginning.
Oh, they kept getting 86s and 88s, and we were like, yay,
and then,
another 86.
And then Parker went back and re-reviewed them and was like, yeah, I was wrong, they're all 95s. And I called up all my clients, I was like, by the way, check your cellar. You just, we're beating this to death, but I want to make one final analogy is, you know, if you were in the Prada Museum and you saw a bunch of Americans walking around and you overheard one say to the other, Yeah, you know, I really liked the Degas, but I only gave it a 92. I gave the Velasquez a 94. Wouldn't you think? I think you guys have missed the point.
Yeah, too much brown here. Did you see how much brown they used here? Too much.
The point, don't you think?
I could not agree enough. I find the whole thing completely ludicrous. And most importantly, because, you know, you're quoting someone who's not there. Who, you know, I certainly say that I have enormous respect for Robert Parker. You know,
yes.
He's a great guy. He's, you know, he's imperious in print, unfortunately. And Brooks No Criticism, which I think is a classic sort of mistake of, you know, ex-lawyer. But he's a brilliant guy, and he's got a great palate. I just don't happen to agree with it, just like I don't like chocolate, and he probably does. And I'm not wrong, and he's not wrong. It's just, you know, our palates are just different. You know, if Parker is coming over for dinner, buy the wine he gave 98 points to. But otherwise, you know, probably buy the one you'd give 98 points to.
Well, and you know, it's not his fault that he became the sole authority on wines. I mean, he wrote in a very accessible way, and he was, you know, it was the rest of us that said, okay, this is the opinion that matters. And that's really changed quite a bit. And now that he is one voice among many, and he has many voices in his own publication, I think the world's a lot more open and a lot better place as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, I'm with you. I absolutely am with you.
And the other thing is, you know, your local people are trusting their local sommelier or their local kid who works in a liquor store who's learning about wine himself and sharing the excitement as he goes from region to region and gets jazzed about something. And, you know, I want to buy wine from him. I want to go on his adventure with him or her.
As we all on the front lines learn more, I think what you see is I have the, and frankly, as the customer learns more, they have a vocabulary that allows the retailer to give them more of what they're looking for.
Yes, indeed. And that's the tricky part, because it is difficult to talk about flavor, as other folks have noted. You know, it's like singing about architecture or dancing about painting. It's
yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the comparison game is the easiest one of just saying, what is it you like to drink right now? And it's why I think one of my frustrations amongst wine buyers is the notion that somebody would drive across town to save $2 when really the key should be that they would stick with the same retailer over and over and over again who knows their taste, who could say, oh, you remember when you didn't like this wine that much because you thought it was a little bit lean or herbaceous? You know, this vintage is much riper. I think you'll like that.
Right, yeah. It could save you $20 on the wine you don't like.
Yeah, exactly that.
And plus it introduces a human interaction into your life, which is way better. Hey, Doug, listen, we're going to take a quick break. I want to come back on the other side, and I want to talk about cocktails and your beverage alcohol resource group and the current cocktail revolution. Will you stick with us for just a couple minutes?
Absolutely.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Doug Frost. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Doug Frost, who is Master Sommelier and Master of Wine, and also one of the founding members of the Beverage Alcohol Resource Group, probably the kind of the authority on cocktails and bartending, the only one that's out there. And so now you have two wine degrees, and you're the founding member of BAR, of which I am BAR certified, by the way. I put that in my signature. What's next? Like the Orange Juice Council? I mean, how many more degrees do you have?
Actually, I have a bad memory. I did an event once for a juice group, and it didn't go well. I still remember it was one of the strangest experiences of my life. I was trying to explain to them how, you know, what they were doing was really easy compared to what selling wine with its regulatory environment was like. And I was throwing a bunch of challenges at them, and the temperature in the room was going down and down. And I don't know what was going on other than I was never called back, except for one thing. As I walked to the back of the room, there's probably 150 people in this room. Two people looked at me independently on either side of the aisle and just gave me the thumbs up and, you know, with a real quiet, and it was like, what did I just
What was
say?
That about?
I don't know, man. I'll never know. It was a strange experience.
Maybe it was like the temperance movement Jews people, you know?
Yeah, Doug, soon to be moving to certifying Angus beef will be his next step.
If it's got alcohol in it, I need to know all about it.
You know, it's funny. I've heard you speak on a number of occasions, and I think you're great. Mark and I do a fair amount of speaking about wine, and people say, you know, you guys are great lecturers. And I often say, yeah, if your math professor gave you three glasses of wine while he was talking, you'd like him too. But yeah, it's an unfair advantage.
And we'll take it.
Maybe that was the problem with the juice council. You should have given them a couple of glasses of wine while they talked about juice. So
I'll never know.
Let's talk about cocktails. Cocktails are the most exciting. I think that cocktails are the most exciting segment of the beverage category, and they have gone through the most meteoric rise in first quality for 6 or 7 years, and then quality and popularity for the last 6 or 7 years. It's a worldwide movement. We've been involved with it with Dale since 93. You know, we have a great cocktail bar here. You are on the front lines of it, and you're a wine guy in a cocktail world. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, you know, I guess one thing would be true that I come out of the restaurant business. I was washing dishes at 15, and then at 17 I was actually bartending, which is patently illegal, but I was in a resort town where I guess people don't check IDs too closely, and so that was my real front-of-the-house job.
Well, plus statute of limitations is up now.
Right.
Beautiful.
Yeah. What they didn't know is you were serving your 16-year-old girlfriend at the time.
Details, brother, details. So, you know, it was that was really my first front-of-the-house job. And then from there, I you know, quit and did some other stuff, and then came back to the restaurant business as a waiter, and then as a sommelier manager, and such. And that was always back there. And so when I got involved in the Master Sommelier program, I remember this kind of quiet that would, you know, it envelop the room when the conversation about cocktails would come up. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, man, have you tried this? And everybody kind of looked at me like, no, we don't know about that. And there's this, to me, this absolutely bizarre artificial line between one alcohol beverage and another. I mean, for God's sakes, you know, half of these spirits anyway are wine-based, and the other half are beer-based, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just distilling wine to make brandy and cognac and Armagnac and Calvados and things of that nature and Pisco and what have you. And you're just distilling beer to make whiskeys and gins and vodkas and such. So I find it really bizarre that there has been a line between the two. It is also, to me, rather false in so much as once upon a time, and I do think this reflects a change in the culture, but once upon a time, people had their drink. I remember, you know, as a bartender,
sure,
we would actually bet, you know, somebody walks in the door and I'd go, $5 of scotch. And the other bartender would look at me and go, dude, he's bourbon. I'm like, you're on. And, you know, the guy'd sit down and I'd be like, so can I start you out with a single malt? You need a blended scotch? He said, yeah, I love scotch. I'm like, $5, yo. And it was, you know, you could do that because people chose a drink and they stuck with it for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And nowadays, and it's been this way for 10 or 15 years, it's like, I don't know, what do you got?
Yeah, I can't stick through a drink through a meal. Forget about the rest of my life.
Well, yeah, I think that's the really part of the problem is that we've segregated it. The restaurant business has segregated it. I think it's a crazy thing, as my friend Steve Olson will point out. You know, he likes to start with maybe a cocktail and then move on to maybe a glass of champagne and then have a bottle of red wine with his meal. And
I've always liked Steve.
Then mezcal to finish and maybe a dessert beer. I mean, you know, I don't want to see the wine list and then have the cocktail list taken away from me. I want to see what you have.
Yeah. You know, I think, though, there are some distinctions that have been made, and I thought about this for a long time. I remember I started bartending in 1986. And I had the Mr. Boston Guide, which was, for many years, the guide to American cocktails. And then for many years, the worst piece of crap between two leaves of book. And then was redone by Anthony Giglio and is once again a very good cocktail book, a very, very good cocktail book. But I opened the Mr. Boston Guide, and between the bastardized, crappy recipes and the ingredients that you couldn't get anymore, or the ingredients that had changed since they were written, and the
the bottle of bitters that had been behind the bar for 2.5 years and was, you know, reduced to a syrup.
2.5 years? How about 20 years?
No, the bar I worked in was only open 2.5 years, so okay. that's how I knew. And, you know, I tried to make some of those drinks, and I thought, Jesus, people in the 30s and 40s didn't know anything about how to drink. These are disgusting, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things I realized through our mutual friend Dale, when we met Dale in 92, and he started, schooled us, and we realized I've been bartending for 6 years, but I didn't know anything, right?
Oh,
and,
totally.
And so we came back and started making real cocktails and learning about real cocktails and seeking out real cocktails. And it was very interesting because people weren't quite ready for it here, and some people really embraced it, especially when you went back to historical cocktails. But, you know, we started in this business as bartenders, Mark and I. And you did too when you were 17. There is a special relationship with the bartender. And look, when you serve wine to somebody, it was made at this vineyard in France or Italy or California. It's a beautiful vineyard. You sort of have this whole romance of it, and you treat it lovingly. And what you do as the sommelier is you sort of, you know about this product that you're taking care of and bringing to someone at an appropriate time. The bartender pops a bottle of that, mixes it with some lemon juice, some sugar, puts an egg in there, and shakes it up. And you know, it's somewhat irreverent to the product in a way. It could be seen as irreverent to the product in a way, but here you have a craftsman
creating
something right there, a la minute. But, you know, the way I view that is, well, you know, the chef takes truffles that are very expensive and makes something for you a la minute, and, you know, that's you would accept that, right? I think the cocktails are made there by the guy while you see them. I think that's a huge difference.
Yeah, I certainly see where you are with that, and I think that the, you know, the sea change is exactly as you said, has been ingredient based, you know, if you will, as Dale will point out, and others certainly, is that if we look at the revolution that people like Alice Waters helped create in the kitchen, it was ingredient based. It was, you know, let's take a look at what these raw ingredients are, and see how we can make better choices about those, keep them in better condition, utilize them on a seasonal basis when they are in the right condition, and not use badly stored or preserved ingredients, and our food will benefit. And it was only a matter of time before the bartender said, yeah, sweet and sour out of a gun. What the hell is that about?
Right. I don't even know what's in that.
Yeah, well, I still don't know what's in it.
Well, and you know, it's a bit different with bartending because we always had in the kitchen, we had the idea of, you know, the chef of being a technique, of a guy who'd master a technique that could make food taste great. And for a long time, a lot of restaurants were working with crappy, you know, preserved, mass-produced ingredients. And then Alice Waters looked at the ingredients and said, listen, let's take this great chef and give him some great ingredients. I think what had happened with bartending was it had fallen much further. Our ingredients had gone to shit. Pardon the French. It's a podcast. I can say that. We'll bleep it out of any on-air broadcast. But the ingredients had gone to shit. And then what happened as well is the bartenders went to shit. And we were great bartenders in that we were friendly to people. We made people's evening. We made things great. But we were using sour mix out of a gun because that's how we were taught. And so we lacked the skills. I mean, I think chefs retained skills and then got ingredients back, and both have increased. I think what you've seen now is ingredients have come in and bartenders are becoming skilled professionals, or there are many more skilled professional bartenders. And you guys are really on the forefront of that movement with the Beverage Alcohol Resource Group. Why don't you talk about bar and what you guys are doing with that?
Sure. Well, it is that, you know, I feel very, very lucky and fortunate that the six of us got together and that we were able to, you know, over now we've been together, working together for 6 years, which is pretty crazy, because I think all six of us at the outset thought, yeah, this will never last, you know. Talk about Clash of the Titan egos, you know. We all have enormous attitude about the importance of our own personal viewpoints. But it came down to, yeah, but we come from the service industry. And so we all had that in common, and we all believed that that was what the purpose of this thing was. It was not to be in love with your information or techniques. It was to, as you said, to make people happy. And that made it really easy for us to always make sure that we were singing out of the same hymnal, to not get too upset because, you know, somebody's lecture needed to be cut by 5 minutes so we could focus on something else. as I think hopefully we remembered why we were there, which is simply to give people some notion of what is possible. And having, you know, somebody like Dale there, needless to say, is so great, because Dale, yeah, definitely was part of my awakening, if not reawakening, perhaps even awakening, when I ran into him again, courtesy of all things of a high school chum who had moved to the Rainbow Room and moved to New York and was working at the Rainbow Room and introduced me to Dale. It was, so what we do now is we try to train as many bartenders as we can, and we try to train them in notions of service, but also in techniques, what's happening now, ingredients. But really, you know, my role within it all, which is to some degree to finally answer the question you asked before, which is, what's a wine guy doing hanging out here? I'm kind of the sensory analysis guy, or at least I'm, you know, one of those people there, that I help people walk through blind tasting of spirits and cocktails and try to break it down in ways that mirror how we approach any blind tasting of any beverage, whether wine, whether beer, what have you, and then begin to understand how that might impact your cocktail, how that might impact your choices when it comes time to make a cocktail, or when you're ready to, as Steve Olson will point out, when you're ready to make an aviation and you make it with Plymouth and somebody says, no, I want Tanqueray 10 in there. You're like, okay, time to adjust the recipe.
Right.
Because it's not going to be the same cocktail.
Well, you know, that's funny that you would say something like that. That's a perfect example of where a good bartender says, oh, gin is not gin. There are many different kinds of gin. And gin's a perfect example, like scotch, that there are many different flavor profiles you're going to get. And, we recently switched over in-house. We switched our scotch, our house, quote-unquote, scotch, to the famous Grouse. And
oh, cool.
We took all of our cocktails that we could, and we rejiggered the scotch cocktails to have the basic scotch be either Black Grouse or the famous Grouse. But there was one, it's an in-house cocktail we make called the Jackie Naylor, and it was made with Dewars, and with Dewars it remains, because it there's no way to rejigger it. And, you know, to think that 20 years ago...
Well, there's no way to rejigger it and make it a better cocktail.
Right, exactly.
Which is the goal of changing the scotch that we're using in-house, was to make it better, and we did not make it better.
But I don't know that 20 years ago I would have thought, oh, I want Johnny Walker Black in that instead of Dewars? Sure, you know, and I would just go make it the same, because, you know, scotch is scotch, especially when you put it in a cocktail.
Well, that was always the great... myth, wasn't it? Well, when you put it in a cocktail, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it'll be covered up.
Well, and frankly, when you put it in a cocktail with sour mix out of the gun, it doesn't really matter. You know, but if you're going to make a great cocktail, it matters quite a bit. The spirit shines through, you know?
Yeah, indeed.
When you have, when the Beverage Alcohol Resource, why don't you tell folks about it? We have a lot of people who are in the industry and a lot of folks who are sort of thirsty for information. You have a couple of different ways.
Funny. Thirsty for information.
Oh, that's good. I'm good with that. That was accidental. You have a number of different ways that people can engage and take the course and participate in the BAR, from an online course to an online course that has an in-person certification, to the in-person course that I took, to now you have even an advanced level of certification. Can you tell us what's out there as far as BAR?
Yeah, absolutely. BAR has, as you say, several iterations, and it's not completely, you know, if you will, linear, but the up to now, the first level has been what's called Bar Smarts, which is a program for bartenders or for people in the bar business. Sometimes there are people who are, wholesalers who really just want to know the basics of it, and Bar Smarts is an online program that includes a series of examinations, and then after you complete all those examinations, then you're invited to a live examination in which you make cocktails for some geek like me, and take a written test, have a blind tasting of a couple of spirits to make sure that you really have done the work and have a good basic understanding of what your role and what your tasks ought to be. The then above that comes this rather large, and definitely only for the truly obsessed, program called Bar 5 Day. And Bar 5 Day is, as it sounds, a 5 day, but 16 hours a day is probably not much of an exaggeration. I think maybe we get some, you know, some people get out of there by 12 hours, but it's mostly 12 to 16 hours a day.
That's the one I took, and
that had to hurt.
You know what? It's really intensive, and I crammed a lot of information into my head, stuff that I didn't know.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is not really us, but it was the fact that you were in a room with like-minded individuals who were all totally, you know, in the moment and exchanging ideas and trying new things. And of course, the, you know, exam is a bit of a bummer. It's a real bummer. You know, it's a blind tasting of six spirits, of two cocktails, a massive, I don't know how many pages that damn exam is, probably 20-page exam or so. You know, a menu exam, you know, it goes on and on and on.
Well, and you also teach in that exam, as I recall, you talk about menu design, you talk about what kind of cocktails would be appropriate for what kind of place, you give people a cocktail menu and say, this is incorrect, find the things that are wrong, or does this cocktail menu work for this type of place in this hypothetical scenario? I mean, that's pretty serious stuff.
Well, it is, as I say, for the truly obsessed. I think it is that... We wanted to create a program that was at that level because we didn't believe that a program was out there that existed at that level of you know, sort of ultimate geekdom, if you will, but really of trying to provide in one setting virtually everything that we thought was important for someone who's a professional to know or at least to be familiar with, and then. You know, you can pass the bar 5 day at the certified level. You can pass it at the bar ready level, which is a more excruciating practical examination, which makes cocktails at a faster pace and yada yada. And then we have a program called Bar Masters, which is probably a bit more in line with what people would think of as a master's program, because not only have you had to pass the bar program at the ready level, but then you go and do individualized study, create a thesis, take a much more thorough examination. And at this point, it looks like one or two people will pass this year. They've both been working on their master's for about 2 or 3 years.
And they'll be the first.
What's that?
And they'll be the first ones.
And they'll
to
be the first, yeah, exactly. And you know, to jump all the way back down to the bottom level is then to say that within a few months we'll also have a program that's more of a consumer portal, or let's say a bartender who isn't quite as obsessed, called Drink School. And it's just, it's going to be online only, at least for the time being. So that should be available online, as I say, within the next 60 days or so.
Well, I'll tell you, I took the bar 5 day, and the people that were in the class were you hit it exactly on the head. It was great to be in there and to go through the blind tastings, and that discipline was terrific to collate all that information. You guys were great. But what was also great were the people that I met from across the country. We did it in New York. Fortunately, I didn't have to go very far, but I met people from across the country, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those people, and I still share ideas with some of those people, and I will visit them when I'm in London or wherever I am, and we still share ideas. And it was almost all bar owners or bartenders on a high level or beverage directors. And, you know, Camper English, who writes about spirits for the San Francisco Chronicle, was also in my bar 5 day. Are there journalists that take the class generally, or is it mostly industry?
It's mostly industry. I think that the average journalist looks at that and says, I'd like to hang around for a day. But,
yeah.
You know, as you saw, the program is so exhaustive, and those 5 days, you know, any attendee ends up so exhausted that there's not that many, you know, Camper is a special individual. There are not that many folks on the media side that are willing, or maybe sometimes even able, to give that much time,
right?
To really see what's going on. But I'm with you. You know, for me, the most exciting part of it are the people that I'm supposedly teaching. You know, many of whom could teach me, or all of whom could teach me something. There's no question about that. And you know, for me, it's just exciting as hell.
Doug, sometimes what happens is you go to New York City for a week and take your Bar Smarts class, and you leave your partner here to do all the work here. sometimes that happens.
Someone had to run the restaurant.
Resentment.
Huh? Yeah. Someone had to run the restaurant, but it was a hell of an experience for all of us. Anyway, Doug, it's been super talking with you about beverages. I could talk to you all day, but I'm afraid we need to bring this to a
a temporary conclusion until we meet again.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed the talk, you guys.
It's been great, and
Thanks, Doug.
We'll see you soon. But hey, stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Isn't he the nicest guy?
I was just about to say, in case it didn't come across on the radio, if you ever meet Doug Frost anywhere, I promise you he will be nice to you, because he is one of the genuinely nice people in
He is from Kansas, Mark.
I guess there's that.
I gotta tell you,
I guess there's that. Most of the people I meet in this business are from New York or New Jersey, so they're just mean.
Or you're from Paris and you don't smile. That's not really true. All my French friends, I apologize. I gotta tell you, and I hope I'm not beating a dead horse with this, but that bar 5-day certification, when he said 16 hours a day, he meant 16 hours a day. He meant get there at 8 o'clock and leave at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, literally Francis called me up like, how'd it go today? Good? Restaurant's good? Okay, you got it? All right, bye.
Well, what's funny is it was held in New York at the Astor Center, which is a phenomenal food and wine space. And
it is
work
a great
stations
space.
And
it's a great space.
And it was the week was full of like theory and lectures and blind tasting, and it was pretty amazing. And if you're a bartender out there and you want to get this bar 5-day, contact them, and we'll put up contact information on our website as to how to get in touch with Beverage Alcohol Resource.
Yeah, but be ready. I mean, it is not something for an amateur or something for even somebody who is a pretty good bartender to get into. This is for you're serious. You've been making serious cocktails for a few years
You've
now.
Been reading about serious cocktails for
you
a long
know
time.
You know history.
You know cocktails.
You know cocktails. You know ingredients.
You can't go into this.
And now you want to move to the next level and kind of put it all together.
This presupposes knowledge, and it presupposes skill. So you can't go in blind. But that being said, if you have a decent amount of knowledge and you have a decent amount of skill, it will really take you to the next level. The other thing is, it's not free.
Right, it's very
several
expensive.
Thousand dollars. But, you know, you're getting six of the top beverage experts in the world to spend a week with you.
And you will be in the room with the top people in the world in the bar world.
In various disciplines. I mean, but what you can do is what a lot of folks do is they generally find a way to have a liquor company sponsor you, to have somebody who's invested in your bar be talking to your reps, be talking to people about, hey, you know, once you know the lay of the land, then you can start sniffing around for scholarships, because there are a lot of scholarships out there because the industry really wants people to have that increasing level of professionalism, but you need to convince them that you're the one that's going to really take this and run with it.
For most people, that online course where you go
the
city for one day and take the exams and do it that way is going to be the way that...
Take a much less intensive exam.
Less intensive, it's less expensive, and you can be a little bit more on your own pace that way instead of dedicating a week of punishment.
And
the week
of punishment was
there,
because I think, well, 5 days, you know, I can do anything for 5 days, right? But it was literally 8 o'clock Monday morning. We finished up with a couple of small breaks in between. We finished up at 8 or 9 o'clock on Monday evening. And I foolishly did not get a hotel room in New York. I said, the train ride back to Metuchen, where I live, is 40 minutes. I'll catch the train. So I had a 40-minute or an hour commute by the time you're done with the subway either way. And here's the thing about 5 days of intensive course. You've got to study that
day.
Right, you
got to study the
materials.
Everything
you learned. So I would get home at 10, study until 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, sleep for 2 hours, and get back on the train to go back to Manhattan. But you know what? Really worth it, and the people you meet are really amazing. And what they're doing is unprecedented. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. My name is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com.